The following programming is sponsored by Clean and Sober Media. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
If you need immediate help, please call the National Substance Abuse and Mental Health Hotline at 1-800-662-HELP. Bottle of wine, fruit of the vine. When you gonna let me get sober? Let me go home and start over. Welcome to Clean and Sober Radio. Brought to you in part by Recovery Centers of America, the nationally recognized leader in drug and alcohol treatment, using proven evidence-based treatment, including 24/7 medically supervised detox, inpatient and outpatient options. You'll receive exceptional care from an expert team of master-level clinicians, physicians, nurses, and staff using 12-step methodology and medications. Jefferson University Hospitals and Thomas Jefferson University, providing excellent clinical and compassionate care in the Philadelphia region, a proven leader in healthcare and education since 1825, and Acadia Healthcare, with locations on the East Coast. Acadia maintains a standard for excellence in the treatment of behavioral health and addiction concerns. And now, here are your hosts, Gary Hendler and Mark Sigmund.
Hey, hi, everybody. Thanks for joining us, and welcome to the show. Clean and Sober Radio features real people with real stories about addiction to drugs and alcohol. I'd first like to thank a lot of the radio stations across America that carry Clean and Sober Radio, and they are WWDB out of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, WWNN out of West Palm Beach, Florida, KDWN, Las Vegas, Nevada, WHFS, Tampa, Florida, and WGAC, Atlanta, Georgia. Mark, what's going on in recovery news this week?
So we have a lot. a new study just came out from Harvard University, and basically it's saying that people with a medical marijuana card for depression and anxiety, that the study's proven that it's more likely to lead to addiction than actually help them.
Well, that's amazing. Yes. I think we... I don't know if we're just cynics, but I think we talked about it before. Yes. This medical marijuana is complicated. There's really no answers. It's too soon. And I guess we'll just have to see what happens, right?
Yeah, and it's really important with anything like this to have data. And you're not seeing a lot of data yet. You're starting to.
Right.
And they were just – basically, people are giving people cards when there's no real reason why it would help for a particular –
Right.
illness.
What else you have?
So we got the former Pennsylvania Attorney General was actually arrested for DUI. Kathleen Kane. Yep. She was pulled over and she actually refused a blood test.
You know what shows me? You know, she was in jail anyway. But it really shows you, no matter who we are, I don't care how much money you have or your position in life, you can get jammed up with addiction.
Yeah, you sure can. And, it hits every element of society.
It certainly does.
It hits priests. It hits athletes. Yeah. I mean, it really goes across the board.
It certainly does, yeah. Hey, what else is going on in the news?
So this is some real bad news. They're starting to see some marijuana being laced with meth and fentanyl. This came out of Pueblo, Colorado, where police are starting to see overdoses from people buying marijuana off the street. And it actually having fentanyl in it. And you're starting to hear it around here, too. I've heard a couple reports of this. And it's very, very it's scary stuff because you have so many high school students and young kids, basically, using marijuana off the street.
You know, it really is disheartening because, I mean, obviously, when I was coming up, you smoked marijuana. It was never thought that it was going to be mickeyed, as they used to say,
yeah.
Something put in it. It was never a thought. It's the evilness and the greed for money over life has taken over society, hasn't it?
Yeah, and we're seeing we're seeing the fentanyl in Philadelphia being mixed with a horse tranquilizer at this point. So they're starting to put all these different things in. Was that you or
sound effect? No, that was a horse.
That was a horse. Okay.
Yeah, that was a horse.
They're starting to put all these things in, and it's scary stuff.
It is scary. All kidding aside, it's scary stuff. Well, listen, as we know, none of this is getting better.
I know.
It just really isn't. Okay. On today's show, we're going to be talking with Sarah Colvin. And if she looks or sounds familiar, she was on a little while ago, and she had an incredibly an incredible story that I'm sure gave a lot of people a lot of hope to get into recovery. Even with a very difficult childhood, you were able to overcome a lot of obstacles. And we're going to hear your story when we come back.
This is Clean and Sober Radio.
If you're struggling with alcohol or drugs, Recovery Centers of America can help. RCA's local inpatient and outpatient programs are founded on science and delivered with heart from an expert, caring team who will inspire and guide you every step of the way. Call 1-888-RECOVERY now to speak with a treatment advisor. At RCA, you'll be in a community that builds connections and fosters support from peers and RCA's team of medical professionals and recovery support specialists. At RCA's state-of-the-art campus in Devon, PA, and Mays Landing, New Jersey, they tailor your treatment to you and also offer specialized programs for patients with history of trauma, for patients who have achieved recovery but are experiencing a relapse, for young adults, adults 50 years and older, a confidential program for first responders and military, and a faith-based program. RCA answers the phone and accepts patients 24/7. And because it's local and in-network with insurance providers, treatment is affordable and accessible. Don't wait. Call 1-888-RECOVERY. Recovery today.
Hi, this is Simon Kirk, and I listen to Clean and Sober Radio.
888-329-3306. This is Clean and Sober Radio.
Hey, if you're just joining us, we're going to be talking with Sarah Colvin. And as I said before the break, if you recognize her name or you're watching us, she was here a little while ago. We just had to have her back because we ran out of time, and her story was so inspiring that we need to hear the rest of the story. So welcome to the show, Sarah.
I'm welcome, super happy Sarah. To be here. Thanks, guys. Really great to be back. Thank you.
All right. So just tell what have you been doing? For those a small group of people who doesn't know who you are, give us a little background. What happened? Because I know there was a lot of trauma in your life. So let's talk about it.
Childhood?
Sure.
I don't know. People talk about trauma, but I don't have I know we referred to it. I had an alcoholic father who made life maybe unpredictable and unstable.
Well, is that traumatic?
Okay. All right.
Absolutely.
Right, Mark?
I don't want to disregard real trauma by saying that I have trauma.
But your trauma is real trauma. Mark, am I right?
Absolutely. It's really considered abuse if somebody has an active substance abuse issue, and it's affecting parenting and stuff like that. So it's definitely trauma. We see it a lot. And so how was it growing up with an alcoholic father?
It left an emotional toll on me. But to qualify also, I think we touched a little bit about this. I'm the oldest of four. So I took on a lot of stuff that my younger siblings didn't. Mm-hmm. And they're all very successful, well-balanced, productive members of society, all of them.
Guess what? So are you.
And so am I today. Yeah. Yes. I just internalized what was going on a lot more than maybe they did. There was just a lot of instability. You never knew what to expect. You know that unpredictability, walking on eggshells, learning to read people really quickly because you don't know how to act or if it's going to be right today or wrong tomorrow, and nothing's the same, and you don't know who to trust or what to do and what's going to happen. So it's like walking on that always puts that anxiety in a child.
What a burden, people that like yourself who have had trauma growing up and maybe didn't even know they had trauma, but it has to affect you growing up. I mean, that doesn't leave you. You need to get help for it. And that can, who knows your addiction was a direct or indirect result of the trauma that you were aware of or were not aware of in your house.
I think that the drugs were the solution to the uncomfortability of being me. And whether that was as a result of me just being born as me, and then maybe exacerbated by what was going on in my family. And then the drugs were like, oh, yes, relief from being me, relief. Because there was a lot I was biting my nails until they bled when I was 6 and 7 years old. I was sucking in my stomach because I thought it was fat at 7. There was all sorts of weird things that I developed. I became super conscious of myself, always, you know, thinking about me and who I am in relationship to other people and learning how to read people too quickly and then making myself either be okay or not okay based on other people.
Did you find yourself, because I did this, comparing yourself always to other people.
Yeah.
Whether you were, you know, it became I'm worse off, I'm better off, and so many things because of the insecurities. And that's why, as you said, relief when you got that whatever drug you were taking, that
Yeah, I walked around. It was just like, thank goodness I found drugs. I probably would have found like suicide or something else. Like, it was hard to be me. And when it's hard to be you and you're already six and you're already seven and you're eight and it's hard to be you at that young age. So drugs were like the relief from that.
Mark, do you think there's a difference if you were traumatized at six, seven or eight as opposed to if something happened to your life and you were considerably older?
I do. I do. I mean, because, you know, you're at stages, different stages of development. And when you're that age, a kid always internalizes it as their fault. You know, a kid has a hard time deciphering and they start thinking it's their fault. And it really affects their self-esteem and their ability to cope. You know, and another thing that happens is a child often, it sounds like in your case, becomes parentified. In other words, they have to take on all this responsibility at too early an age, so they get cheated out of their childhood.
Especially, are you the oldest?
I am.
You hear that a lot with the oldest child becomes a parent figure.
Yes.
Out of what?
Out of necessity and out of wanting to take care of the parent rather than the parent taking care of them or take care of your siblings. And then what you see a lot of times is like this caretaking turns into a lot of codependency later on. In other words, like often somebody that has done a lot of that growing up will find, you know, an alcoholic partner or a sick partner to take care of, you know. So
yeah, you do hear that a lot, don't you?
Yes.
It's amazing. So, okay, you had – so let me ask you something. So your dad was a problem. How was your mother growing up? And did she realize the effect of your father's actions on you?
I think that – so my mom was stable, consistent, reliable, faith-based, you know, kept us emotionally – we knew we were loved. We knew all the time that we were loved. We always prayed together every night. We had certain things. We had routines in place that kept some stability in our life. I don't know if my mom was your typical enabler, but she probably just told herself day in and day out, we're just going to get through this for today. We're just going to get through this for today, just for today. What ended up happening, and yes, she knew because I was such a what is the word when you're a little bit too outspoken? I was aggressive with my dad. Like, I don't like this. I don't like this. Why isn't he changing? I don't like this. That was me. I'm always outspoken, saying what I think and saying what I see. It's to a fault. but I would tell my mom constantly, you know, daddy's doing this. Daddy's doing that. Daddy's doing this. So she definitely knew. And when I was 11, I think, he went into rehab. He had totaled a car. He went into rehab. So she was aware that there was, like, some concerning stuff. But when I was 13, he was arrested with my little brothers in the car.
Oh, no.
And that was when my mom was like, okay, you have to leave now.
So if you're just joining us now, we're talking with Sarah Colvin, who has overcome an incredible amount of obstacles in her very young years. And she is now an author. She's in long-term recovery. And she inspires a lot of people. And if you want to give a call and you want to talk to Sarah, it's 1-888-329-3306.
Yeah, Sarah's – I actually met Sarah 15 years ago or something. And it was just always amazing because just to watch her work a program. You know, works a real solid program, you know. So your dad's alcoholic – Your mom is, you know, kind of doing a lot of different things. And what was it like when your dad finally left? Was there like a sense of relief? I guess there was sadness. It must have been a very confusing time when he finally left.
So I thought it was going to be the best thing ever. I remember, like, you know, those moments like 9/11, you remember where you are and what you were wearing and what was happening. You know, it was one of those kind of moments. I remember exactly where I was happening and what the response was when my mom said, your dad's leaving this summer. And
Let me ask a question. I hate to interrupt you. So you were glad when your father left. Did you feel any kind of guilt that you caused the rift between your parents?
No, I had this 13-year-old mindset that said, my life's going to be better now.
Wow.
That was what that's what I thought. I thought that he was the problem and removing him was going to solve the problem. But I would – like that's what I say about like our childhood and stuff. You could give me – and you could put me in a perfect environment and I would still be me. I would still be me in any environment, and that's the addiction piece. Like that is it, because my dad left. Life got stable and I got worse. I got worse inside.
Yeah. She's the type. She's a gal that the cup is always half full.
I am.
You know that?
Oh, yeah.
I wish I had that. You're so positive, you know?
I know. And I'll talk. And I'm like, no, I don't see it that way, Gary. I see it the opposite.
There you go. But we see it. We see it. That's all right. So how old were you when your dad left?
13.
13. Okay. So what happened now, 13, 14, 15 in your life? Because your father left and everything was going to be fine.
It was devastating that I was still left with me. But I found a boyfriend. I found codependency real young. That kind of stuff started. I dropped out of not high school. I dropped out of all the sports I was playing. I stopped doing that kind of stuff. And I started to rebel. And I started to become my father, the role my father had played, the chaotic, the disorganized, the troublemaker, the turmoil in the family. I became that. Like my dad left and I stepped up to that and I became that, like literally.
That's amazing.
I think there's a study on that, right? I remember being in Livergren and doing a class on like family roles.
Oh, yeah.
There was like the middle child and the oldest child. And and I was like, wow, that's so applicable. You know?
Yeah.
Because really, you took my dad out of the situation and I became problem child.
It's amazing that the family's like a living animal.
Yeah.
You know, and you take on these different roles. And then when, just like in that case, there was a void there.
Right.
You know, because the family had adjusted to living with this chaos for so long that you stepped up.
You know, I like that analogy you just said, that the family becomes like a living entity, you know, that starts moving in different directions and things happen, good, bad, and that's an interesting analogy, Mark.
It is, and this is the importance of getting a family involved in treatment, because it's going to really rock the family when somebody gets clean. You know, you're going to have you know, a caretaker, for instance, an enabler that doesn't have a job anymore, right? You're going to have different things that really throw the family's homeostasis off at that point where they were used to this chaos. And so it's super important to get everybody involved, because the family's got to adjust too. I've literally had people try to sabotage the person that was sober, and subconsciously, because they needed it to be the way it was before. That's what they were used to.
No matter how bad it was, they didn't want the change.
Yeah, they were a caretaker. It gave them a feeling of power. It gave them a feeling of being important. You know, it was like a job for them. And then all of a sudden, they don't have this job. And it was an identity for them.
Well, it's also intimidating if you become clean to the people you were hanging out with who were using.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I remember when telling people when I got out of rehab, I can't be with you anymore. And they didn't want to hear that. That was like, oh, you're better than I am now? It was that kind of attitude.
Yeah, and especially if somebody has their own addiction problem.
Well, they all did.
Yeah.
Right?
And then next thing you know, it's like it like makes them think about their own issues.
Yeah.
And so there can be some sabotage there too. So you took on this new role, and when did it start leading to substances?
I was 15, and that boyfriend that I got at 12, we broke up at 15, and I was just like emotionally depressed and devastated, and I'm 15, and I feel like an identity crisis, right? You took away the thing that had made me, mm-hmm. and you took that away from me, and I turned to drugs. I found cocaine, actually, and I was like, oh, I feel so good. This is exactly what I've been missing my whole life. It was like everything I wanted.
What was the circumstances the first time you used? Where were you? Who were you with?
The first time I used was alcohol, and I was at a bonfire in the woods in my neighborhood, and I was with a girl from school, and I didn't know anybody else but that girl, and they handed me something to drink, and That was the first time I used alcohol. I hated it. I blacked out. I threw up. I hated it. But the first time I used cocaine, that was a different story. I fell in love.
Yeah.
I fell in love. That did for me what I couldn't do for myself.
Isn't it crazy? I remember, you know, first getting high and thinking to myself, this is the answer to
for sure.
all my problems.
Oh, absolutely.
You know what I mean? Like, this is the answer. Yeah. Isn't that crazy how our mind works?
We're so broken, right? Like, we have the disease of addiction that needs to be addressed because you take the drugs away from us and we are still that disease of addiction. It's still in there.
You remember the first time you used?
I do. And it was with pot. And then the first time I used pot, you didn't really get high the first time, you know. But then I remember when I did start getting high, that whole period where it was like, yeah, I'll use this every once in a while now, you know. And then it was like, you know, I'll use this every weekend. And then it was like, well, just at the end of the night, you know. And then it just started spiraling. You know.
Every day that ended with a Y.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. I mean, it's crazy how that happens.
You know? And, you know, nowadays with the drugs that are available, they can kill you. When we were coming up, I'm going to say you and me, I don't know about Sarah, I could take as many Quaaludes as I wanted, smoke as much dope as I wanted. It didn't kill you.
Yeah. You know, the rates of death or whatever, people back then would look now and be like, you've got to be kidding me, you know, in terms of the amount of people that were dying each year.
I agree. I remember, so I was born in 81, but I remember there was two people in high school that I remember hearing about in the neighborhood that overdosed. And then I remember when I was clean in NA, the very first person I knew that overdosed. And then there was like a handful of people. Now it's like people can count off by the hundreds.
My younger daughter said to me, people are almost numb by it. They've heard so many people have overdosed and died.
Yeah.
Isn't that terrible?
Mm-hmm. It's terrible because I get young people, young adults in treatment, basically all of them will say, I've lost, you know, five friends or three friends or, you know, and they'll go on about how many people they've lost. And I don't remember that at all.
Me either. No, I never, ever.
Yeah.
We're going way back. God, you were 1 year old when I got clean. That's
really,
really depressing.
I love that.
Or it's very good.
Yeah.
Either way.
Yeah.
You're ancient.
You're an old-timer.
I'm older than you. Let's put
yeah,
it
yeah,
that
you
way.
Are. Yeah.
Okay. So you started using you're probably hanging out with bad boys, bad decisions. Yeah. You picked the wrong guys. Did your mom know? Did your siblings know you were starting to go down?
They couldn't not know because I'm unmanageable from the get-go. My compulsive behavior starts and takes off like insane. And so it just snowballed really quickly. Yeah. By the time I was 16, I was addicted and everybody knew it. And I dropped out of high school at 15 years old. I was not showing up. I was angry. I was violent. I was mean. I was selfish. I was stealing. I was smoking. All sorts of stuff. And it was quick. It was a quick progression. So by the time I was 16, I had already been to rehab.
Right. So when we come back, we're going to continue talking with Sarah Colvin. And Mark and I would like to get into more, you know, what exactly, vividly, what did your life become when you started using and all the horrible things that come with that? And we will be right back.
This is Clean and Sober Radio.
Huntington Creek Recovery Center is Eastern Pennsylvania's premier provider of transformative care for individuals whose lives have been impacted by addiction. Our 40-acre campus offers a tranquil, recovery-focused environment. We specialize in evidence-based care that addresses the effects of trauma and offer a unique program specifically for adolescent males. Huntington Creek Recovery Center can help you achieve lasting sobriety. Call us today at 844-948-2320.
888-329-3306. This is Clean and Sober Radio.
If you're just joining us now, we're speaking with a young lady, Sarah Colvin, who has, despite the obstacles in her life, has really shined. I mean, you're an author. You're a mom. You're an inspiration to so many people in recovery. You're in long-term recovery. You have a great attitude. And we just love having you on the show.
Yeah, we do. It was the first thing we said when we were like, we don't have a guest Friday.
Yeah.
Call Sarah.
And
I love you guys.
What about Sarah? She's just been on. Hey, man, we didn't hear the whole story, okay? Bring her back.
Yes.
Bring her back.
It's a great idea.
All right, so you're, what are you, 15 and 16 now? What's going on?
I got pregnant at 16. So my addiction is, so my using years, I think one of the differences for me is that I used all the time constantly and I just dedicated my life to it. So I wasn't somebody who partied on the weekends and went to school. I wasn't somebody who like drank through college and then became an alcoholic. Like I wanted to use cocaine every single day of my life and that's all I wanted to do. So I didn't go to school anymore. So things got bad really quickly.
Where'd you get it?
Really quickly.
Where did you get the coke?
Down the city.
How'd you pay for it?
I don't remember. I don't like way back then. I stole a lot from my mom.
Okay.
I do remember. I opened a credit card in her name back then. Yeah, I stole a lot from my mom. And I was also waitressing at this cafe down by Jack's Marina in Croydon. So there was some of that too. And I was babysitting sometimes. So basically, I stole.
Yeah, I can totally relate to that.
And then we would go to the city. That was the only place I knew where to get it back then.
So again, I don't know if you answered the question. Your mom, your siblings, did anybody try to get you to stop?
Yeah, everybody. Everybody. So I got pregnant with my older daughter. I was 16, and that stopped me right away. So I was clean for a year. So that's why I say, like, my addiction through teenage years, and I've had two relapses that lasted 18 months and 2 years, but I've had my main addiction that started me on drugs was a total of 3 years, from 15 to 19. And a year of that, I was clean because I was pregnant. And then I had Layla. And it was another one of those ideas that my 16-year-old mindset told me, like, she's going to make this my life perfect. Like, my dad's going to leave. It's going to be perfect. Like, there was always this idea that, like, when something changes in my life, everything's going to be perfect. And I was always still left with me. Like, so here's this baby. She didn't make my life perfect. She needed me. She's a helpless infant. I'm 17 years old. And again, it just sunk in that, like, here I am, left with me, once again, you know, the insecure, the selfish, the neurotic Sarah. So I started using again, found heroin at 17. And from 17 to 19, it was just like a blur, just a wreck, in and out of rehabs. My mom kicked me out. I think there was one or two arrests. It was just a wreck.
Was there a difference in your life when you were using at 15 or whatever, 16, and you did not have a baby, and then you have a baby and you're using again? Are there a lot of guilt feelings and a lot of, I don't know, shame and everything else that goes with that, especially when you have a child? Didn't that ruin the high?
It was hard. My mom let me live with her only for a little while, because then she was like, this isn't going to work. You know, you can't do this with the baby. And I remember how hard it was for me, like, wanting to stop and holding my baby and rocking Layla to sleep at night and just thinking, I can't stop, even for her. Because I couldn't figure out why I could stop for her with a pregnancy. But now that she's here, I can't stop for her anymore. And I could not understand why I had the ability, like 18 months ago, found out, oh, I'm going to stop for my baby. And now here's my baby and I can't stop for her. Like, that's the power of the disease of addiction.
Cunning and baffling.
Yes. Yes. Overwhelms the most sincere desire. I desperately want it to stop and couldn't, even because I loved her. And I do love her tremendously. And I did back then.
You know that feeling. I mean, the number one feeling was to get out of your head, no matter what.
Yeah, like then it becomes like just to deal with everything,
mm-hmm.
right?
Our first go-to coping mechanism, right? And I also know that the body, I'm sure you know this, Mark, being in the psychology profession, the body like traps stress and traps trauma. Mm-hmm. And so also dealing with like just literally jumping out of my skin, like from all that anxiety and all that fear and all that like tumultuousness growing up, like to internalize that in my body, jumping out of my skin,
well,
literally.
It's jumping. A vicious cycle. Mm-hmm. I mean, you feel horrible. You want to get out of feeling horrible. You start using, you feel horrible. It just keeps going and going and going.
But then you can't stop because, and one of the things of not being able to stop is you're like, you try to stop and you still have this other issues going on, right?
Yourself.
Yourself.
Yes.
Quite an issue.
Yes, quite an issue. Everywhere I go, there I am.
I love that line. Everywhere I go, there I am.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, true. It's like, you know how like, we think like a geographical change or something like that. And then it's like, man,
you know what they say about a geographical change? It's like changing your seat on the Titanic.
Yeah.
I get that. You're going down, buddy. You're going down.
You're going down. You're going down. So how old's your oldest child now?
Layla will be 24 in August.
So does she know your story?
Yeah, she lived it. Yeah.
I know, but as a little kid, well, you were six when you started to understand. I mean, how old was your oldest daughter when you started to talk to her about this stuff?
So I was two when she got she was two when I got clean in NA, and I was clean for 9.5 years. So by the time she grew up, and even in kindergarten, she was going to NA picnics. She was going camping trips. She was going to meetings. So it wasn't a life. She didn't know the addiction part. Like, before you're two, how much memory do you really have? Yeah.
Right, right.
So she didn't know that. She just knew her mom was in recovery. And she could say, like, those people are using drugs, because we talked about it. Her dad is still in prison to this day. Like, we talked about, like, what drugs do to people. But then once I relapsed, she didn't really know what drugs actually do to people. Like,
and she was so adorable.
She still is.
Oh, my gosh. She still is. Like, would have these shoes that would light up. Like, yeah, this is at, like, 5 and 6.
Yeah.
And yeah. But then – so then you – it must have been quite a shock. How did that relapse happen? You know, the one that's the most recent one.
The one when I had 9.5 years or 4 years? I had two relapses. I had one when I had 9.5 years. I was 28 years old. And I had one in 2010 after 4 years clean again. And Layla went through both of those with me. One time she was 11, the next time she was 17.
What happened in 2010?
I had gotten over addiction, I think, in my head. And I was better than addicts.
That's a trap.
It is. I was clean for more than triple the amount of time I had even gotten high for. You know, I had a bunch of degrees and a bunch of success. And I thought, oh, I had outgrown addiction. People think, you know, they outgrow addiction and that's not me anymore. And it's still me.
And it was Costa Rica, right?
Still me. I was in Costa Rica, right? And it was alcohol again. It was pina coladas. Uh-huh. I was never even a drinker.
So what you were? Yeah. Were you on vacation or something?
On a business trip, yeah.
And what happened? What happened?
Nothing bad happened. It was wonderful. It was wonderful. The sky was freaking purple. My feet were in the sand, and a round of pina coladas came along, and just
for
like that.
That second,
I was like, I like smoothies. This will be fun. Like, but that thought crept in and became okay after a year and a half of not being a part of NA anymore. And I was completely out of the recovery conversation for a year and a half.
I find it so amazing how your brain can trick you.
Oh, my God.
I'm amazed. I just, you know, that second when you have a decision.
10 minutes before, you never could have told me I would have drank again or I would have started
drinking. That's pretty scary.
It is really scary. Yes. And doesn't it show, like, the vigilance that we need in our regular maintenance of our recovery programs?
Yeah.
It truly does.
Oh,
like,
God.
You took me out of the – I'm surprised I lasted a year and a half. I'm really, really surprised I lasted that long.
As they say, the addiction is just doing push-ups in your head and – you know, you drop your guard and you can get into some big, big trouble.
In the end, right.
And you think, you know, you go back into denial and it's not like you had a bad thought about, like, hey, I want to do this and cause problems. You thought, like, I'm healed.
I like smoothies. This will be fun.
Yeah, like,
right.
Alcohol was never a problem.
Exactly.
Right?
Crazy. Craziness, right. So, you know. 6 weeks later, I'm a daily blackout vodka drinker. 18 months later, I lost my house. I lost my car. My daughter's living somewhere else. I'm homeless and, you know, shackles and handcuffs and heading off to Bucks County Correctional Facility. So that was fun for 18 months. Not.
That's amazing.
And you know, just hear that whole, I'm on the beach. It's like that, we call it euphoric recall when you remember the times you liked, right? Like, I'm on the beach. This is great. I can have some pina coladas.
I'm far away from home.
I'm far. Yeah,
maybe nobody will know.
Yeah, it's alcohol. That was never a problem. So to you, it appeared like a solid decision at that point, right?
It was the next good idea. Isn't it amazing, though? Like, that thought had not crossed my mind. I had lost the desire to use almost a decade before that. And the thought never became a real possibility until right then and there. And all of a sudden, it was then. Like, it's like, oh, yep.
It was just waiting.
Scary.
And you, at that point, subsequently lost your daughter, your house, all those horrible things. How did you say to yourself, what happened?
Yes.
Did you? Yes. So you were cognizant or you're conscious of this was not something horrible has gone wrong.
Yeah, this was devastating. This was but once you're in the cycle, like, I honestly couldn't stop. I honestly could not stop. I had to be I know that I had to be placed into jail in order to stop at that point. I was so far gone. I was using to die. I wasn't using to get clean. I was using to die. So I knew that I had to be placed into jail in order to stop.
What were you charged with? What weren't you charged with?
No, we committed 15 commercial burglaries in the 4-week period, and I was charged with all of them.
Interesting. So, you know, we know you're an author, and
yes.
You have a book called Breaking Free with beautiful handcuffs around prison bars.
Right. That's because it was written in jail.
You wrote it in jail.
How did it come to that?
You're in jail. You're bored and say, hey, I think I'll write a book.
Because I was facing 5 to 10 years in state prison, and I was desperate and dying. And my mom told me that I better get praying, and maybe I should make some use of this time. So I picked up the pen, and I started praying, and miracles started happening. And I made a lot of internal changes and physical changes and started to do some self-discipline. So the recovery program that I had always known, and that book came out of it. And another 4 years, you know, long-term recovery came
out
of it.
How long were you in Bucks County Prison?
I did a total of 6 months before they released me on drug court.
Drug court. And then you were on parole for how long?
Drug court was a 16-month program at the time in Bucks
County. That wiped out the prison stuff?
Yes. Yeah, for me, it did. Well, if I didn't complete drug court, I was going to be stipulated to 5 to 10 years in state prison.
State prison.
Yes. But I successfully completed the program of drug court in 16 months, and then I didn't have any probation.
Do you ever hear this? Somebody say this? Sarah, you're such a pretty girl. How did you do this? I hate when people say that. They say it about one of my daughters who's fine now. Oh, she's so pretty. What's that have to do with anything?
Or like, you're so sweet.
So sweet.
I know. Put a drug in me and I'll probably steal from you. Isn't it funny? Because in my heart, I actually am genuine and I'm totally sweet and I love life and I have a passion for people and totally like feel good about the world. But put a drug in me and it takes over and I become somebody else.
So when's the last time you used?
December 27th, 2017.
Right after Christmas, was there a reason you wanted to have another Christmas in there, didn't you?
No. It was a bad time. It was a bad, bad time. And it was another, you know, homeless situation. I found another drug. I found meth for the first time in my life at 35 years old. Because I was always I was always a Kensington runner, like coke and heroin down in Kensington. That was my game always. And then I found meth in the last 6 months of my relapse, changed the game, changed everything, and that's what brought me to my knees. I don't know that I would have gotten clean had meth not taken me to the insanity that it took me to. Meth got me clean.
Did you ever use meth?
I did. I've used amphetamines, not meth.
There was a smell, I remember,
like
it was
a burning smell,
a burning, industrial.
Yeah, that's exactly. It tasted like a chemical.
Disgusting. But it wasn't disgusting enough.
It took me to a place in my mind where I didn't know what was real and what was false, and mm-hmm. I didn't know who I could trust and what was going on. And it was so, so bad. So down in the city, like, I know that if I sit down, you're going to steal from me. There's no expectation that you're not. Like, I know what I'm dealing with. And I actually know, like, if I go get my stuff, I go walk on the corner, I'm going to get my stuff, and this is where I go. There's, like, a level of I just know what I'm going to expect. But in the bar scenes, in Lower Bucks County, in the meth scene, it was just the backstabbing, the two-faced. And then the meth you're on, you don't know what's real and what's false, and you don't know who's real and if somebody's out there and if they're not and who to trust and are you being real? Is my camera bugged? Is my phone bugged? Are they after me? That's like a mental level that I couldn't tolerate. I could not handle it. Meth brought me to my knees and got me clean, for sure.
The paranoia.
So
I mean,
bad.
I never experienced it. It must be frightening.
It's so bad. It's so, so bad. So that was a different experience. And the 6 months on meth are what brought me to my knees. Nothing I ever experienced before. It was devastating.
How was the meth high different from your other highs? From heroin?
I'm not. So I was always a stimulant person because I like to be up. I like to be busy. I like to be efficient, you know, productive. And cocaine and meth let me do that.
Yeah.
Heroin was only good for me because I liked it because I hate it coming down from cocaine. I hate the experience of coming down. Mm-hmm. And the only reason I liked meth, the single only reason I liked meth, was because it lasted longer than cocaine. So you had to shoot up a lot less of meth than you did for cocaine. Mm-hmm. And that was the only reason I liked it.
It's amazing to me, being an addict, even being an addict, to hear somebody talk about shooting up, putting chemicals in their, you know, in their body. And it's just like, as a matter of fact, you know, yeah. I did all that horrible stuff.
I had really bad veins. And so to say that I only had to put needles in my arm twice a day instead of 15, 30 times a day was good for me. And, I've had so many abscess surgeries and all that stuff. So that's why I mention it, because it was a role in why I went with meth.
So do you think any of the drugs that you used has caused long-term effects on your body?
Of course. Even on my mind. Yes. I still – so when I got clean, I had twitches that would not stop. I went to a neurologist when I was 14 months clean because I was still experiencing like twitches like this, just random. I have a lot of neurological symptoms, a whole lot of neurological symptoms. I had a tic. I had like a speech impediment. I had, oh my goodness, I grinded my teeth for 4 months constantly. So much, even mentally, the not knowing what's real and what's false can cripple me sometimes to this day. And I'm not, and I've been clean for 4 years.
Sure.
You can talk to Larry, my boyfriend, and I will be in a place where I don't know what's real and what's false at any given moment. And it's really, really scary to be that mentally fragile at times. And I know it's a result of the meth.
Is Larry supportive of your recovery?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Is he in recovery?
He is.
That's awesome.
That's good stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Hey, you know, let's just do a little roll call. We haven't done that. Debbie Reynolds is watching. Marit Holmgard is watching. I hope I pronounced that correctly. Shelly Shell is watching. We just want to recognize some of these people.
It's funny because mine aren't showing up for some reason today. It's weird, but
did you flip it over this way?
That's a great idea.
No.
Here you go.
Listen, I'm technologically.
Oh my gosh. Well, and Sarah, another whole side of this for you was the double trouble of the eating disorder, right? You had a serious issue with that. And
that's what led me to my first relapse and probably my second relapse. You're right.
So are you a member of OA?
Yes.
You know, it's amazing. I want to mention this. I'm not going to mention her name. I always thought to go to OA, you had to be obese. And it has, for many people, it has nothing to do with that.
A lot of people have that misconception.
It's what sugar, white flour does to
you. Food addiction.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Food addiction. Yeah, I was bulimic. Actually, anorexia brought me to Overeaters Anonymous at 22 years old when I was 2.5 years clean.
Yeah. Hey, listen, if you're watching or listening, if you need help, call the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Hotline at 1-800-662-HELP. That's 1-800-662-4357. It's a legitimate. It's across the country. They will get you help. And it is available. There are no drive-thrus and there are no delivery services, but there is help out there.
Sure is. And get it early, right? Get it early, as early as you can.
Right?
So it doesn't go to the lowest of low bottoms.
We've been saying this for five, six years.
Yes. You said 400, well, 300 shows with me, I guess.
At least.
And 400 with you.
At least.
Yeah. It's. But I'll tell you, so your recovery is double-sided. You have to keep an eye on the eating disorder and the addiction.
It's super true for me, yes.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's just more complicated, you know?
Absolutely.
But it was like, so when I had 8 years clean, I relapsed into the bulimia because I was, like you said, coincide. My bulimia recovery was coinciding with my drug recovery, and everything was going very smoothly for about 8 years. And then I relapsed at 8 years. I had like a betrayal by a guy in my MBA program that I was like emotionally connected to. And it was a betrayal, and I turned to bulimia, and I relapsed in that area, in that addiction. And it was like living with an active addiction for a year and a half. So it's only time before, like, what I really want is cocaine. You know, what I really want is drugs, what I really want. So it took a year and a half. But living in that addiction and that obsession and that compulsion over and over and over again is eventually going to lead me to what I really want.
We're talking with Sarah Colvin, an incredible young lady who has overcome a lot of obstacles. And when we come back, we're going to hear what your life is like today and all the great things that you're doing.
This is Clean and Sober Radio.
A cancer diagnosis can knock the wind out of you. The Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Abington Jefferson Health can help. Our brand new Asplund Cancer Pavilion brings you 86,000 square feet of cancer-fighting science for truly comprehensive care. Backed by the strength of an NCI-designated cancer center. Call 1-800-JEFF-NOW. The Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Abington Jefferson Health. The power to out-science cancer.
Hi, this is Gary DiCarlo, the voice of STEAM, and you're listening to Clean and Sober Radio.
888-329-3306. This is Clean and Sober Radio.
1-888-329-3306 is our number. If you want to give a call and talk about anything, especially introduce yourself to Sarah. All right, so tell us about your – look, our lives are never perfect, but your incredible life compared to where it was.
Yeah, things are different. I have two little girls now. I have two toddlers and super active in 12-step fellowship, really, really active. We just started a meeting a couple months ago in May up in Newtown on Wednesday nights. That became my home group. Give back as much as I can.
It's a women's meeting, right?
It's not.
Oh, it's not. Okay.
A what meeting? What'd you say?
A women's meeting, I thought. But
no, it is not. 7:30 on Wednesdays in Newtown. And I enjoy sponsoring people because the more that I can think about you, the less I'm thinking about me. And that is a great position for me to be in, you know, not thinking about me. No, I have two little girls. They're three and they're 18 months now. And Larry and I are doing a great job with them. They're happy. They're three. Well, my three-year-old's moody, but she's still – they're well taken care of and they're well-balanced kids.
So you have all girls?
I do. I have three girls and I have a five-year-old granddaughter. So I'm just girls all around me.
So Larry is surrounded.
And we do have a dog. His name is Cooper and he is a boy.
Oh, that's good. Oh, that's good.
That balances it out.
All right. So, okay, the kids are in school. You know, you're managing a full life.
Yes.
And you're going – meetings, you're involved, you're giving back. Yeah. What else? What are the other some more accomplishments besides your book, which is a pretty big deal? And by the way, we want to mention this book can be purchased on Amazon.
It can, yeah. Amazon is a great place. Yeah.
Breaking Free.
Breaking
by
Free.
Sarah Colvin.
Yeah, that's good.
That's one of the funnest things that I do in my life. It's one of the funnest things is we did. It was actually published just a couple of months before COVID hit and shut the world down, and we only got to do one event. We did one book event in Yardley right before the world shut down, and it was so much fun. And that's what I'd like to. And this is so much fun. Just talking about recovery, talking about the book, and getting it out there. And it was so much fun. That's what I'd like to do more of, actually, is book events and get the book out there. Just talk about the conversation of recovery.
Do you work? I'm not saying being a mother is not work. What else do you do in your hectic life?
It's totally fine. I go to a lot of meetings, and I work part-time at a restaurant in Langhorne.
Okay.
And I have the book. And I'm looking for more stable employment, I guess. So I did. I've had a lot of jobs in the last I had two babies in the last 4 years, but I've had a lot of jobs. But I also have felonies. So, and my MBA isn't totally useless, but I am looking for more substantial long-term career, more stable career, more profitable, beneficial employment, more satisfying employment.
Sure. Your oldest daughter, is she a really good big sister? And
Layla?
Yeah.
My older one. She doesn't live with us. She still lives in Croydon with her daughter. And okay. we live out there with our two little ones. Yes, she's great. We just took the girls to Princess on Ice last night.
Nice.
It was so much fun. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. But my older daughter has a 5-year-old, my granddaughter. And then, she's great with the two little ones.
So you have a granddaughter. I was doing the math in my head. So your daughter is 16 years younger than you, right? Is that about right?
Yes.
That's amazing. I mean, it's almost – you can almost be a friend with somebody like that.
Yeah. I became a grandmom at 35. It's a little unusual. My two little ones are older than my grand – are younger than my granddaughter. So we're going to raise them as cousins probably. But it's they're great. A lot of girls. A lot of love. A lot of happiness.
So your life is really full. You've been in recovery. You're reaping the rewards of – you're reaping everything because you're being strong and you know exactly what to do to stay sober.
Well, it does take work, right? It takes work. Like I still face myself. I still face my – I still work a program. And it's not like happily ever after, I don't think. I think it's maintenance and I'm still a work in progress. You know, my family's still a work in progress. My life is still – my career is still a work in progress. So, yes, there's a lot of things that have stabilized. But there's also – areas of my life that I want to grow in and that I want to get better with constantly.
You know, I think everybody needs to understand recovery, sobriety, everything is not a joy. I mean, you have obstacles that you have to overcome. You know, why me? I'm clean and sober. How can this happen to me? Because it's life and you have to be strong. That's, you know, if you want to stay clean and sober, you have to be strong, even with these adversities.
Yeah, we have to have support, too, around us, you know, and we have to be willing to be honest about what's going on. So I can get through anything usually as long as I'm honest about it. The second I start to keep secrets or I think I can't tell somebody, I start to get ashamed of what I'm thinking or what I'm going through. The second I start to keep secrets, I'm in a pretty bad place because that'll lead me into a dark corner, you know. But if I talk to anybody about anything, no matter how neurotic, how shameful, how hurtful, I talk to somebody, it usually becomes okay for me.
Yeah.
I can carry it a little bit easier.
Do you still have to use like meal plans and all that? I remember you're using for the bulimia, the meal plans and all that. How active are you? I still
follow food guidelines. I do. I still have foods I stay away from. I still have foods that are not, you know, they're addictive foods for me. In a way, they call them your alcoholic foods. They're addictive foods for me.
What foods do you stay away from?
Processed foods, all sugar. I'm sure just like your
sugar.
Processed foods, sugar, white flour, caffeine. Caffeine is a no-go for me.
Well, you sound just like my wife.
Yeah,
I think I need that. I'm just so hooked on sugar.
A lot of food addicts are similar. There's addictive substances.
Yeah, but here's the thing. If you eat a lot of sugar, you're not going to rob somebody.
No, but if I keep eating a lot of sugar, I might want to use the drugs that make me rob somebody.
And it's crazy because food, bulimia and stuff is – there's more fatalities from that a lot of times.
And anorexia too.
Yes. It's crazy. I mean, you would never think so, but it can definitely kill you.
But I'll tell you what is missing, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, there's really not the shame of OA, like there's a shame of addiction and AA and NA. That shame, if society doesn't view somebody who has eating disorder, I don't think in the same way they view drug addicts.
I agree. And we as you know, food addicts don't go to the levels we had to go to for drugs to get our food.
Yeah, right.
You know, there's not a lot of stealing or lying or you know.
Unless you're robbing a food fair or a supermarket.
Yeah. Right? So the degradation isn't quite the same. But the self-obsession and the obsession and the compulsion and the self-hatred and the remorse and the internal consequences are identical.
That's very interesting, isn't it? That's cross addiction.
Yes, it is, and it's just you could just see how your recovery has to be multifaceted and you do yoga. Right?
I still have an active exercise life. It's still important for me to be active. Yeah. Even if it's getting outside with the girls and taking walks. We have a couple machines down in our basement. I do some yoga moves, yes. Breathing, meditation, yes.
Fantastic. You know that?
I did that 10 years ago or 15 years ago, whatever it was, Mark. It was a part of my recovery then.
Yeah.
Well, but for somebody like me who's a little bit high strung, a little bit too much energy, a little bit too excitable, somebody like me, like meditation,
really?
Even if I do 6 minutes a day, twice a day, it can slow down my mind. And over time, it helps me. And the exercise to channel this energy that is me is really important too.
You know, you help. I don't know how many people you're helping today.
A lot.
Because your attitude and the, you know, showing everybody that it can be done.
Yeah.
I don't care what your background is. If you really, really want it, you can get into sobriety. And you're incredible.
I think that we all stand a chance, right?
We all stand a chance.
Yeah. It's not easy. It takes work, right?
And we also need to know where you do get help. Where do you go? That's not an easy path sometimes, because there's not a lot of answers a lot of time where you can get help once you make a decision that you want it or need it, you know, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, I a big part of yours is the 12-step program, right? It's huge, and the spirituality. But amazing.
Amazing.
Amazing, Gary.
Amazing. No, really, that's why
we're
cornballs,
by the way.
That's why we brought you on again so soon, because your story inspires a lot of people.
With the two corny guys.
Yeah, that's right.
You guys are great. I love you guys. I'll come on anytime.
You will.
That's great.
Of course.
What are you doing next Friday?
Exactly. Follow up.
Follow up.
Yeah. We're coming to the end of the show. What are you doing this weekend, man?
I am doing nothing. I'm going to my home group tomorrow night.
Yeah.
And it's going to rain tomorrow. And if it was nice, I'd go fishing. But, you know, not much. How about you?
I don't think anything, to tell you the truth.
We're
I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know what I'm doing, okay? My wife's in California, so...
We got to call each other at some point, you know?
Yeah, we're so boring, it's not funny. Let me see what we got going on here. It's almost the end of the hour. Again, thank you so much,
this was
Sarah.
So much fun. I love being with you guys.
And we love having you. And
we
you're
do.
Just, you're a joy, and the best of luck to you.
And get the book, guys.
Get the book.
Hey, remember, if you or a loved one is struggling with addiction, help is available. Please call 1-800-662-HELP. For Clean and Sober Radio, I'm Gary Hendler.
I'm Mark Sigmund.
Thanks for listening. To learn more about this broadcast, please join us on our mission at cleanandsoberbroadcasting.com.
Everybody wants to shine.
I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves. I hope we pass the audition.
The dust.